Maimon that the Rabbi Fatsuit, the Rosh Hashiva Yeshivas Madrega to Adam, is able to join us on a short trip he's here. Rabbi Fatsuit is also a Rav in Hillcrest, the Hillcrest Torah Center. And he also is descendant of the original Madrega to Adam, the altar in Navarik, who you've heard about over the course of the year, one of the main disciples of Rishon Lezion, started an Avodah Kedusha movement, wrote the Sefer Madrega to Adam, and we spoke about the unique aspects of the Avodah Kedusha and the yeshiva that Rabbi Fatsuit leads and heads. Also tries to instill some of those principles of Kedusha in the yeshiva, and it's a big zechus that he's here during this time of year to speak also about his experiences when he was here 41 years ago, 42 years ago, during the Six-Day War, and with his experiences with some of the great rabbis who in Yerushalayim at the time. Thank you, Rabbi Fatsuit.
Thank you, Rabbi Elton. Thank you very much. Thank you, and everybody. I'm excited to be able to talk to you. I'll tell you why. This is a little bit of a prelude to a drasha that I'm going to give later on, probably Friday night, and I'll tell you what I mean. I came here for 5-6 days to visit a lot of the yeshivas to recruit for Madregas Adam. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the yeshiva, but a lot of Talmidim who were here before are learning in our yeshiva now, quite near Queens College. And it's a very, very solid learning program with Musar. At the same time, you know, we really work our programs to allow to incorporate the secular schedules that they have in Queens College with the learning schedule, so you can kind of like maximize everything you're doing without getting burned out or overwhelmed. That's our niche. And I'm sure you mostly, first year boys, right? When it comes second year, you'll probably hear a little bit more about us. Hopefully I'll come back and do it, talk about it. But the point I was leading to was that, as Rabbi Osher mentioned, I was here 42 years ago when I was your age, actually maybe exactly your age, most your age, and I was 19 at the time, and I came to, and I was in Eretz Yisrael from 1965, so I'd spent 2 years, a little bit more actually, in Eretz Yisrael, and then this war broke out. I'm coming back 42 years later, and I wasn't sure I was going to be here, actually. It was a little hard for me this year to come to recruit. And turns out, because it was Yom Yerushalayim this week, it's Thursday, I believe, or Friday in America, it's Friday here, they celebrate it Thursday. And Yom Yerushalayim, I figured, you know what, I have to be here Yom Yerushalayim. I'm not a big Tziyana, I'm never a throw, but I have to be here on Yom Yerushalayim. I'll explain to you why. As I told Shiva this morning, I'm going to ask you, does anybody know the word in English, serendipity? Have you heard the word serendipity? Do you know what it means? Not the movie, the word. There is a movie. They told me in my shul there's a movie too, but it's a word. It's an interesting word. It's a word you should keep. It's a little one of those vocabulary treasures that you pull out and makes you sound very intelligent, even if you're not. But serendipity means like this. Actually, Webster says it's a gift that was found of something valuable that was not sought after. Did you hear that? A gift that you found of something valuable that was not sought after. I'll tell you what a serendipity is. You're on a plane and you're traveling. It's a working trip. You're in a bad mood to begin with. It's a miserable flight. You're sitting next to this old man that keeps on plopping and talking to you and doesn't let you rest. And by the end of the trip, he tells you that it's such a pity on him. He's old, and everybody he knows is dead. And he has no father, and he has no mother, and he has no sister, and he has no brother, and he has no children. And all he's got in his life is $10 million. And you're the first person that ever listened to him in his story, so he's writing you a check for $10 million to bequeath everything to you after he dies. And you get the money. That's serendipity. Now you all know what the word serendipity is. That's serendipity. Again, it's an important word. It's a gift that you found of something valuable that you never looked for, you never sought after, fell into your lap, right? I asked recently, what was the most serendipitous moment in the history of this generation? This generation, meaning my generation, I'm the baby boomer generation, you're the children of baby boomers. So we share a generation. Meaning as opposed to, let's say, my parents were European, old people, ancient people, antiquity, those old days. Me, I'm not still one of the guys who lived in, maybe they do think we live in the olden days. but I'm not that one. So, you know, this generation, I ask you, what was the most serendipitous moment in our history? And it's really, the answer is very simple, very clear, because in your mind, you couldn't even perceive a more serendipitous moment than I'm going to describe. In 1967, this I'm sure all of you know, all of the Arab nations joined together. There was a pan-Arabism, it was called at the time. And Nasser, Gamal Nasser, he was the head of Egypt at that time, and he swore that he's going to drive the Jewish nation into the sea. And I think it was at the time 100 million Arabs surrounded 2 million Jews, and this went on for months and months. They closed the Straits of Tehran. The tension kept building and building, and pressing and pressing and pressing, and all the nations. Syria at that time was Iraq, and Iran a little bit was Iran with the Shah then, so Iran wasn't, they're not Arabs, you know, Iran is not an Arab people. They're Farsis, they're Muslims, but they're not Arabs. So it was Iraq, and it was Saudi Arabia, and all the nations, you know, Libya at the time was rather more powerful, and they all got their armies together, was massed at the borders, and it was this absolute destruction. The question at the time wasn't if Israel is going to be destroyed, or if everyone in Israel would die. They knew they were going to die. The question is, how would they die? Would they die slaughtered, butchered, like sheep? Would they die heroes? Would they die fighting? Would they run away and commit suicide, maybe dive into the sea? It wasn't if we will live or die. It was a matter of, we will die, but you're going to say, how you die? I, being a young man at the time, and I draw back a little bit, the story will be a little bit out of sync in terms of its chronology, but you'll understand why as it unfolds. But one of the things that was very important to me in my experience was building up to it. I was in the Mir Yeshiva, that I was a Talmud Mir. We're learning the Sefta Nedarim at the time, and it started at the very beginning of this month. And a month into this month, and here we are right about June, it was getting. There was a lot of tension, and you knew the war, it's just a matter of days or maybe a week or two till it would break, and so everybody ran away. Everybody left. All Americans, all English, we had a lot of English used to learn here, the English left. From Belgium they left, everybody ran. And a few Americans stayed. Now, I got a ticket to leave, it was hard to get tickets, there weren't enough flights leaving, the planes were just back and forth and back and forth, like they were just, everybody's running. So I got a ticket for Wednesday before the war broke out. War broke out on Monday morning. So I got a ticket for Wednesday. And my grandfather, Zecharon Lebracha, Rav Rom Yaffin and his Rebbetzin, at the time they were in their 90s. 80, he was 88, she was 90, and they obviously couldn't endure a war, they would die even from the tension, so we got them out very quickly. They were American citizens. They'd only come here for a little bit at the time. So I'm going back, I decided to go back with my grandparents, and they've gotten me a ticket, and I go down to Lut, it was not Ben Gurion at the time, and I take them to Wednesday before the war broke out, and then you know when you look in passport control, the way it was then, you just went through, waved your passport like this, and you know, the guy said, okay, go up, and you go on the tarmac, and you go up these steps, and it was a small plane. They had no jumbo jets in those days. No, didn't even have the first 747.
Danny Eisner.
Yeah?
Mecca Zavadni. Forget now. And,
he remembers.
He said, move up to
Yeah. So remember, they used to go like this, and you showed his passport, and maybe sometimes they'll stamp it. At that time, nobody was stamping, because if you remember, every single soldier was drafted and was sent somewhere. And I'll tell you, I mentioned this to you earlier about there was no minyan. It was the only time in the history of Yerushalayim that there was a pekuda from the Eda Achreidus that there's not allowed to be any minyan in Yerushalayim. No minyan, even for Ovel to say Kaddish, Mabat, and everything. No Kriyas HaTorah. Kriyas HaTorah is Osir. Can you imagine that? Osir Kriyas HaTorah. The Sifrei Torah probably were wondering why doesn't anybody open up the Oren. And you know what the reason was? The reason was because there was no need to go to the minyan except who would know. Old people, yes. But you had all the yeshiva guys who didn't go to the tzava. There were young guys, your age, all your age, healthy young guys, a lot of married who are older, 21, 22, 25, 27, and they go to minyan in the morning. And all of the people in the streets, the women, would come out into the street and yell at them and scream at them, Tidbayesh lachem! למה אתם לא בצבא? בעלי, הוא עכשיו נמצא שם, הוא ימות עוד מעט, ואתה הולך להתפלל במניין. He said, my husband is going to die. He's standing in the front. And you walk like this, like you have nothing on your head to go to him again. And they used to start crying. And the women used to come and they used to tear the clothes from the younger wife. They used to hit them. And because they thought their husbands are dead. Every woman would walk out, she thought that she's going to be an almona tomorrow. There was no normal person anywhere in Eretz Yisrael that woman that thought she wouldn't be an almona. More than that, she figured she will die and her children will die. It was not possible to live. I can't explain to you. It wasn't possible. There was no Tzahal. You all know Tzahal. You think there was Tzahal? Nobody knew from Tzahal. They didn't know we had an Air Force until we bombed El Arish and we bombed the daylights out of the Egyptians. That's how we won the war. And technically speaking, of course, it was Yad Hashem. But strategically on the ground, we did a preemptive strike, bombed out completely El Arish, so they were disabled, and we chased everybody away. The legionnaires fought like devils. You'll see soon. We almost got killed because of the Jordanian legionnaires were the best soldiers in the whole Middle East. They didn't even want to fight. I won't say that the story. They were drawn in. Hussein didn't want to fight at the time, and Nasser made him fight. It was a big mistake. That's how we got the coast. All Nisim and Hashemayim, crazy things happened. But again, I'm trying to build you the scenario. There's no way you could live. Tzahal, we didn't even know they had an air force that was Hashu. We didn't know. We didn't know. And on the ground, who knew our Tzanchanim, our people, there was no name. There was like the Haganah. For all we know, it's old Haganah. And you think that a small country can ward off armies of 80 million, 100 million people? It's out of your mind. So no one really in their right mind thought. So Wednesday, I take my grandparents to the airport. I go on the tarmac. I go onto this LL plane. And I take their old people and I put them in the seats and I close the seatbelt and then I sit down and I close my seatbelt and I'm sitting next to a rabbi of the Rosh Hashiva, Teddy Adams was his name, the Chayim Lebracha, and I say, listen, you got to do me a favor. I'm leaving. I can't go to the United States. I can't. These are people I stayed here with for years. I love them. They're my family, my best friends. You know, you feel Israeli at the time. You know, we were sewing tachrichim together. We used to sew. Remember, they didn't have enough fingers to sew tachrichim, so they were preparing tachrichim. So they got young yeshiva like they take them out 3-4 hours at a time, and they take
tachrichim are body bags.
Body bags. Trout, because there wasn't enough. There's going to be 100,000 people, 500,000 chalil are going to die. How are you going to put them in tachrichim? And by the way, for those of you who don't know, tachrichim, you have to have tachrichim for burial. It's even more important than a tari. You can't, without tachrichim, you can't bury. You can't bury. And there weren't enough. And body bags, there weren't enough. You had yeshiva guys who were going, they really did. They got yeshiva people who weren't formerly at Tzava to do certain tasks, and they put them on certain madim. They didn't have enough madim. You think they had clothes? They didn't have clothes for everybody. But they would go, at that time, near Beth Shemesh, there was a place they used to make the body bags for the army. They couldn't produce them fast enough. There were no body bags. They were so scared, the whole country was caught off guard. They were caught, they decimated the whole country. They didn't know what to do. They really didn't know what to do. Levi Eshkol was then the Prime Minister of Israel. He got an early right on him. He was nobody in control.
Dayan was a tzedraita. I mean, I'm telling you names that I don't remember. Dayan was a tzedraita. Yigal Alon was a kofer bicha. Everybody was something else. Yitzhak Rabin, also at the time, they made Yitzhak Rabin then to be in charge of the government. He got a nervous breakdown in the middle of the war. It was crazy. There was nobody running the place. It was like the insane were controlling this island. It was terrible. You had some good soldiers. You had really some funny generals, good soldiers. You had some people who really had mishum. They still had a lot of mishum in them. It was very important as things evolved. So I decided, certain this rabbi, and I said, I can't do it. You know what? I'm leaving. My grandparents, they're going to freak out when they hear that I'm not on the plane. They're going to think, where am I? So you tell them that I just decided I have to go back, and you know them. This rabbi knew them from many. Do me a favor, when you get to Idlewild, I think it was still Idlewild, I don't know if it was Kennedy at the time. I think it was Idlewild, whatever. Maybe it was already Kennedy.
It was
still Idlewild, right? You get to Idlewild, so my parents will be there, you'll take care of them. And I got off the plane, and I decided to die. This is not a joke. This was a conscious decision on my part that if they will die, I will die too. I mean, I knew what I was doing, but I was young. When you're young, you're reckless. It was a decision that I would accept to die if I have to die. I didn't want to die.
That part they know about, yeah. Reckless.
Yeah, reckless, you know. But I remember that, not that I want to die, but I knew walking off the plane, the odds are that I will die soon. You hope you live. Everybody was waiting for miracle, whatever you're doing. And I got off the plane, listen to this. How to get back to Yerushalayim? How do you get back to Yerushalayim? There's no tachbura. Every car and every bus and anything that moved, even a horse that moved in the Eretz Yisrael, was drafted into the army. They commandeered every vehicle. The army didn't have enough vehicles. A civilian couldn't get tachbura back. There was no way. Unless you had to have Ishur for a taxi to take you to a hospital, for a taxi to take you to an airport, you had to have an Ishur. Without an Ishur in that walk.
From Lod to
Yerushalayim. Part of the way I got with a farmer. He was driving an Alta truck, he was an old man, so he took me for about 20-30 kilometers and it was only one road. Remember the old road to Yerushalayim? It was like this. The old road to Yerushalayim, one car, a bus, two buses couldn't go at the same time. But so one would pull over to the shoulder of the road, and the other bus would go, and that was the only way. And it was a winding road. So anyway, but it took me a little bit more than a day. I went by night. I was walking, but I was walking with a lot of people. There were a lot of people walking. And everybody had to walk wherever they were going. So it took me over a day. Very little. I got to drink something. The trip was terrible getting back, but I got back. Got back to Yerushalayim was a wonderful. I have to tell you, when I walked into the Miri Yeshiva, and my family, they still remember. They mention it to me every time. Every time they saw me, they start to cry and they hug you and they say, "You didn't abandon us. You didn't abandon us. You didn't leave us." They couldn't stop saying, "You came. You want to be with us." It solidified a kesher. Not only with the family people I knew, but all those chaverim that I had. You know, you come in, you're like a little bit like a hero, and then bang, you go on the back. You came back. And all these years, they remember it later. This is little things like that they will always remember. So here I am settled in. Now I jumped. It was Wednesday, Thursday, I'm back. It's Friday, Shabbos, Moitzei Shabbos. I still remember Moitzei Shabbos. We were drinking. We never drank. We didn't drink. It's even then this was the
club. Not H2O.
What happened? We spent the whole night up, and I didn't even think of this till just now telling you. We spent the whole night, Sir Shabbos, up, filling up bags with earth to fortify the Miklatim. That they didn't have enough of either. So it's 2 o'clock in the morning, 3, our hands were bleeding. A lot of them were doing, they weren't shovels. There were no shovels. So you do it with your hands, you fill up bags. And we were tired, and we were scared. And you keep hearing on the radio, the Arabs were broadcasting propaganda, and they interfere with the Shidurim. And you would hear that we're going to get you, and we're going to burn you, and we're going to make ovens again. I still know all kinds of terrible, terrible things. And that's, I still remember one of the Israelis going around giving the bakra drink. It's good. You'll get a little shikr, you know, and it won't hurt as much. And we're really, really, very, very down. But we're still yeshiva. We still were in yeshiva, pardon me. We're still yeshiva. So Sunday morning, Reb Nachum Partzovitz, I don't know if you know the name at all, they wouldn't know Reb Nachum, but Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, you heard of. Yeah. Chaim Shmulevitz was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir Yeshiva. He had a son-in-law, Reb Nachum Partzovitz. He was maybe the Lamban then of Eretz Yisrael. He used to say the big, the best Lamban Shashir. And he was ashamed of her. Everybody used to come from far and wide to hear him, Reb Shmuel Rozovsky in Ponovich, and Reb Nachum Partzovitz in Mir. Gives the shir at 12 o'clock Sunday. No, 12 o'clock gives the shir. How many bachrim in Yungalite there were? There was maybe 30, 20, 30, 50. I don't remember how many. Not a whole yeshiva because the yeshiva was empty. A lot were in the army. Remember I told you, they didn't let, the only ones who were able to go out, by the way, the young people couldn't go out, the ones who didn't go to the army. But the ones who could go out were Americans. Only Americans could go out because Americans used to wear funny little thin ties and little brim hats. So everybody knew Americans. Americans, they used to go outside. The Israelis used to say, oh, good, 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 you stayed with us. For them, it was a chizik when the Americans went out. Even all the Israelis liked it, even the chilonim. So now, Sunday morning, and the shir is not big, and it starts, it's 12:30, in the middle of the shir, with the shir on the city, and you learn the mirror? You all know how the mirror looks. Big windows, you know, the giant windows. All of a sudden, you're just like I'm saying, that's the noise. And it's more, not just tick, 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 it's tick, 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 literally clicking, clicking, clacking. And all of the windows are shot out. And bullets are ricocheting off the mirrors, big, all over the wall, glasses flying all over the place. How far away? You see that building over there? That's from where they were shooting, like from that building that I'm pointing to. Because Mir was right by Shah Mandelbaum, by the Mandelbaum Gate, and all the Jordan, it's so good that someone remembers it. Makes it so much better for me. They were right over on top, and they were machine gunning the place. And everybody, so instinctively, what he hit the floor. Everybody's on the floor. Rashir froze. And he's on the bima, and he stands there. I still remember like this. I was in the front seat. I used to write the shir. The tape recorded a few, used to write. I was one of the writers. I was writing the shir down. So I reach up, I reach up with this hand, and I snake my finger, one finger I got around his tie, and there was another younger man next to me, David Freiman, tall guy, strong guy, he grabbed him by the lapel, together we yank him down on the floor, and then we start pulling him, like a sack of potatoes, we're pulling him and we're also down, and we're pulling him on the floor, on the balatas, and it just coming. Until we managed to pull him out into the hallway. And then we're out of the line of fire. There's still machine, the bullets are ricocheting, the glasses are all over the place. And everybody runs down to the miklat. There's a miklat all the way downstairs. We're in the miklat and everybody's wiping away the dirt and the blood and the glass and the no one was shot. Everyone's yelling, are you shot? Anyone shot? No one's in my book. But everyone's cut. We're cut all over. There was a lot of blood because glass was like flying. You know, the reason I asked if you were at the mirror because the whole walls are glass. They're giant windows. They're extraordinary. And so everybody was hit. There was nobody who didn't have shards of glass all over. And then, you know, while we're all like tumbling, you hear another shot, you bang, and you know, but it wasn't a bang. It was the Rosh Hashiva had gone like that on a shtender. And everybody got frightened again that there was a shot. And the Rambam Maltech Altishtazeh. And if you did, and the name is Dagin Diaz, and the Rambam, and then the Rashba, and he continued the shir. And he finished the shir. I had a big Yafnish Maya. When I pulled him with this hand, I was so frightened, probably my finger froze around my mother like this, and I had a pen, I guess, in this hand, and I pulled him like this the whole time. And it gives that punch, and I'm still holding my machberet. So I open it up quickly to where I was up to, and I write in English, guns, 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 guns. And then I write, and the Rambam holds not like that. And I finish the whole shir. After
after the shiur, it turns out the machine gun, every shiur he ever gave was taped. The machine gun bullets, though, had destroyed the tape recorder. That was the only shiur that Rav Nachum ever gave that they didn't tape. And I had the record of the shiur. The only one that had, really the only one that they knew had the record. I still have it, and I brought it here. I forgot to bring it in the taxi. I realized I'm going to bring it to show to you. I have that machberet, and I wanted to bring it back to the mirror now, 42 years later, to give it to the Rosh Hashiva's wife. You know, here, you can have it now. Here's that shiur that was written down. And to me, the startling factor of that moment was, you know, they say the Kohen Gadol is not allowed to be metamed to a mace, not even to his father and mother. Other Kohanim, you know, the Kohen, it must be Kohanim, you know, the Dinim can't be metamed to a mace, but the Shiva Kroivim can be metamed. Why can't the Kohen Gadol be metamed to a mace? What's the difference of the Kohen Gadol? So, Rav Yaffa writes, I mean, there is the Pshat, the Parsha Pshat, he was a Rambam, there's a din in Kohen Gadol, that the Kohen Gadol, when does he go b'fnai b'fnim? On Yom Kippur, right? But the Kohen Gadol's Kavanah, a whole year has to be b'fnai b'fnim. In other words, he can't be Masiach from the Kedusha b'fnai b'fnim a whole year. That, by him, l'fnei Hashem Tamid means more than the regular Kohen, means l'fnei Hashem in the Mikdash. But l'fnai b'fnim, that's a much higher presence of Shechina. You have to have a tremendous intensity of kavanah. The Mela, if a kohen would be Masiyah Das, even for a relative who was Nifter, so it's like he rips out of himself the Machshav b'fnai b'fnim, and that the Kohen Gadol is not allowed to do. So the correlation is, where is the only mashal of b'fnai b'fnim that we have? We're like the Kohanim then. When you're sitting and learning, you're right now in that Makom HaMikdash, because once the base of Mikdash was Chorav, Eloi LaKadosh Baruch Hu, Elo, Dal Lamesh El Alachim Bilvad. We are in Yeshiva. We are the Bifnai Bifnim. As they say, there ain't no other Bifnai Bifnim. It's all here. So when we're learning, we're the Kohanim Gedolim. So are we supposed to be Masiyah Das for mundane things? I mean, you're sitting and learning a Rajma, in the middle of Rajma, suddenly come on and say, okay, when are we going to the restaurant? Or you're in the middle of learning a sugya, and someone will come on and they'll say, okay, when can we go and arrange this trip that we're going to take? You're not supposed to interrupt your... Some people, so he writes, that he remembers how some people had actually transformed themselves in their strong makshava to be able to focus on their learning to that degree, that this is what Rav Yaffet writes. There was a guard in the yeshiva one time, his gun went off in the yeshiva. So everybody, when the gun went off, everybody jumped. One bachur in the yeshiva was learning, just didn't miss a beat, kept on shuffling, didn't hear it. Biologically, it didn't penetrate his ears. That's the kavanah the Kohen Gadol had b'fnai b'fnim. That's a certain madrega, very good. This Rav Nachum that I told you, this was a moment that we were this far from death. I mean, this far from death at that moment, and he didn't miss a beat. He just went, and the Rambam says. And that there's a certain heroism, a certain love for Torah that you have to have, and there's a certain, I guess, responsibility of being a Rosh Hashiva that he wanted to project, that enabled him at that moment to maintain his composure and his poise, and to present something of this nature. That was Sunday. We were all, after that, I don't remember second Seder. I don't tell you the truth, I don't think, I don't remember. Just know it was bad. It was very bad. We were scared. We didn't know what to do. So I'll tell you two things I remember from the next morning. Monday morning I got up, and we thought it was any second. Everything was bad. And I decided that I would go to the Mandelbaum Gate, and I'm going to look a Jordanian soldier right in the face. It's a silly thing to do, you know, it's a reckless thing to do. So I went. All of a sudden, this is 8:30 in the morning, I heard, the azaka went off. And this was the real thing. He knew this was the real thing. So. And I'm standing by the... At that moment, so you look at the soldiers, there was the Swedish soldiers
who were guarding.
And Mandelbaum, I should explain what Mandelbaum Gate was, the crossing between Jordan and Israel. And on this side were Jordanians, and there were no Israelis. They never allowed Israelis on this side. You had to have international UN soldiers because, you know, it never was equal. So at that moment it went off. So the soldier, the couple of soldiers that were on the other side, pulled a gun off, and the Swedish soldier, who was about 3 feet away from me, but maybe this far, he grabbed me here and he kicked my feet out from under me. So I was on the floor, because 3 feet high there was a cement barrier. And he said, go on your stomach. He said, go, run away, it's dangerous. So also, it was second day already, I'm crawling on my stomach. And I want to escape. And I had to be like about half a block. Now I'm safe, I get up, brush myself up, I'm running to yeshiva. Two things I remember. One thing is a woman walking in the street. I thought she was an old woman. She must have been 35. As an old, but I remember her just walking like drunk in the street and just crying like this and saying, Ben Shelly, I stood there. I just wanted to stop to help her, but I didn't. I ran. I was frightened. But I remember like she was shell-shocked now. She just crying, that I remember. The other thing I remember is this. So now it's about a half a minute later, and I'm by Miri Yeshiva, and I go up the steps to Miri Yeshiva. All around the Miri Yeshiva were Nachum peace. It was a different world. That whole neighborhood around the Miri Yeshiva was Nachum. People who lived there, some old Yerushalayim who lived there, mostly it was a very bad, poor neighborhood, so it was Sephardi, poor Sephardim who lived there, who were not, no, at that time, there were the people who'd come, you know, as refugees, a lot of, they came over the years, and it was a poor neighborhood, but as I say, there was Sephardim in particular, and they were Chidonim. They were not that to you. And here I am, I walk to the yeshiva, and all of a sudden, you see two old men. That was Haga. Haga means civil defense. They used to take the old people who couldn't serve anymore in the army. They didn't give them guns. You know, they gave them muskets. You know what a musket is? Like in the American Revolution, they had like the wooden hand. They had muskets that didn't work. They looked like guns. So they looked official. So they are standing at the door of the Miri Yeshiva with specific instructions not to let anyone into the Miklat. Because the most dangerous place in all of Yerushalayim was the Miri Yeshiva at the time. Why was the Miri Yeshiva the most dangerous place? That was the one place that all the Arabs in the world wanted to get. Not because we were learning Torah. Why would they want to get the Miri Yeshiva? If they had one choice in the whole world at that time, then what could they destroy? Well, maybe with the Knesset they might have wanted, I don't know. But they no. It was better than, the reason was because in those days they didn't have satellites. So how did the army communicate? Remember how we communicated then? That was satellite, with phones, with antennas. Anybody who's ever worked with antennas knows, how are you the most effective with an antenna? The highest it is. The highest building at that time in Yerushalayim was Yeshivat Mir. So the army, 3 weeks before, had set up their whole command post on the roof of the Mir Yeshiva. And they knew this. So they wanted to get to the Miri Yeshiva. So this was the target. Haga had been instructed, don't let anybody go down into that Miklat, that's suicide. Because if they have the upper hand, let me explain, this far, right? So imagine, and these were fierce fighters, all of the Egyptians ran, they were cowards. And the Iraqis never even made it, they turned back right away. In Ramat HaGolan, they say there was fighting with the Syrians, it was pretty tough fighting. But the fiercest fighters were the Jordanians. They were really fierce fighters. If they were made it across this Midrash, you know, they met in the middle of that ammunition hill. That's where all the time Khalil came in, and that's where they had the worst crowd in Yerushalayim, and we lost 212 soldiers in Yerushalayim out of the 632 that died in 67, and most of them was on this Midrash. In between, called Ammunition Hill, Givat HaTachmoshet, and that's how this is where the mirror was. It's like 80 meters away, 90 meters away. What if they would have? And it was hand-to-hand fighting. It wasn't fighting where, you know, like you see on television or in the movies, you know, with all these goggles and
from far away. It was infantry fighting hand to hand with bayonets. It was not old time fighting. And it went for hours and hours and hours and hours of fighting. If they would have had the upper hand for 15 minutes, what happens? You got to push. That's how hand fighting goes. What if they had the first push? And they pushed another 130 meters. Where are they? In Mauritius. Mauritius was slaughtered everywhere. So it was the worst place to be, because their focus was to get there. So this I remember, I came, it's 8:30, a little down, 8:30 in the morning, when we didn't know, by 8:30 in the morning, the war was over. Technically, the war was over. What had happened was, 3 hours earlier, the Israelis, they sent their air force into Sinai, to El Arish, where the Egyptian air force was situated, and they bombed out every Egyptian plane. So now there was no air force. The Arabs had no air. Who's the only one who had an air force in the Middle East? They had some MiGs, the Syrians, and they tried to use them, and Hussein from Morocco sent some, but it didn't help. We knocked them out. We knocked them out. It was over. The war was over. BBC was the first one that reported it later in the day, but nobody knew. All we knew is this hand fighting. I come and they're standing there with the guns. There's no one letting them in. And I remember just women and children all lined up on the steps, yelling and screaming and crying. And here's the story. There's one woman, I still remember how she looked very vividly. A tiny woman. She was very small, very thin. She had three children. She had one child, her oldest, she was holding like this. She had another child, a baby, she was holding under her arm. And then she had another child that was holding her on this side. I remember vividly. And what I remember is, like this, when a person yells, what you have to redeem over here, how do you say redeem?
I don't know.
The veins were sticking on. I remember her was sticking on, and she was yelling at the man, Lama ta lo mevin? Anachnu rotzim rak b'yeshiva. Lama ta lo mevin b'yeshiva? Anachnu rotzim rak b'yeshiva. Anachnu rotzim. She was yelling. These are not religious people, but at that moment, you know what they want to be? Rak b'yeshiva. Why don't you understand? She's yelling at him. Finally, they gave in. They said, these are, especially Sfardim, they're very, you know, even the ones that weren't religious, they're 10 times more religious. And they want to be rak b'yeshiva. And they moved away. 200, by the way, approximately 200 women and children went into that shabbat. Altogether, for men, there was about 30, 35 men. What time is it now, if I may?
22,
okay. Let me pick something. So, it wasn't good from the get-go. It was 8:30 in the morning, so even those who came to yeshiva didn't really make it to yeshiva yet. That's why I said with a few, Rosh Hashiva was there, Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel, actually, he used to become the first one of the yeshiva in the morning, so he was there already. Rav Arya Finkel was there. Actually, Rav Yitzhak Ezrahi was there, of names that some of you might know. Anybody know Yaakov Hapfer, a great rabbi in Baltimore? He was there, was my age, and he was there at the time. Some Yerushalayimer were there. Mazia, there was a big Talmud Chacham Shaul Mazia was there. And that's it. The rest are women, and women and children. And Rav Nochem, and he sits down. Rav Nochem sits down at the shir, like at a table, and there was about eight around him. He's learning the whole time, but we started at 8 o'clock. So he said Lama Levin. So I think we said some Tillim, and they said Lama Levin. We're learning. At 11 o'clock, this is what happened, it's Monday. At 11 o'clock, you heard something like, you were down, yes? When you used to hear like this. You know what that is? That's 3-4 miles away, they're called Totachim, old-time mortars. They would shoot, two would come out. The first one would make a hole, the second one that would come in would explode. So you'd always hear it, it would go, and then it would go, you know, it's not make-believe, you really would hear, but if it's far away, you didn't hear. But then when it hit, you would hear, thump-thump, you hear, thump-thump, it's far away. They couldn't hit you, because from 4 miles away,
it's like you have now in what's the name of the place where they shoot the rockets? Shterot. Like in Shterot, they shoot the rockets, there's no accuracy. They didn't have much accuracy. The accuracy was, they would shoot for hours and they'd say, don't move it a little over to this, move it to this angle. But it depended on the wind, it depended from far away, you had very little accuracy. So he started at 11, 12 o'clock. We would learn, we were trying to learn, but you hear, well, before you heard like this, now already here. Bum, bum. It's a little more. Then by 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock already, you would hear boom boom, and the ground you feel a tremor on the ground. Feel it because it hit maybe 20 blocks away, but there was a tremor. I still remember at that point when we started feeling the tremor. So I mentioned Rabbi Hopfer. So I remember looking up at him and I saying, yeah, do we think we could still maybe get to the airport? I remember asking him, like, just kidding, is it possible we could get to the airport? Is there anything? And I remember him going, you can't make it. You begin to lose it. You're not brave, you know, when the Grim Reaper is coming, you know, you don't have courage. So it was getting closer and closer. And this went on. Let me jump a little bit. This went on for hours, and psychologically it breaks you down. And it went, now there's a lot in between. I won't go to all the stories in between, but it started at 11, 11 o'clock at night. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz had yard site, and he davened for the Yomid then. Once a year, he davened for the Yomid. That Myrav, the davening and the crying, but that was not yet at its crescendo because it was getting closer. And there were hits on the block. You heard the soldiers, the tanks. You would always hear the tank. A tank rumbled. It was in front of our base. They were all going to give us the order. You heard the foot of the soldiers. You heard them yelling. Sometimes I would ask some of the guys, Shalano or Shalem? Shalem or Shalano? You never knew. Because we were deep inside, we were afraid. Maybe the running is coming from the Arab soldiers that are about to come. We didn't know anything because the radio wasn't recording. There was only music on the radio. That's how it is in Israel. Music, and it would go all songs all day, but you had to listen all day because sometimes they would stop and they would say Echad Arba Shalosh Tesha. That was a simon, and then you'd see when he said that we only had one guy who had to go. It was toward the end, and he was with a commando unit. I only remember his last name, Friedman. And this was, let me tell you this part of the story. I'm jumping, but the Totachim were coming in. It's 11 at night. It's 12 at night. It's already 13, 14 hours. It's really close. They had one hit already that they hit the balonim next to the yeshiva, and the balonim exploded, so the gas came in. You know, the gas comes into the yeshiva, and everybody vomited, and the whole place was full of partly. It didn't smell good, but you had from the gas, everybody, but you could live, we were still alive. And it was terrible, it was a Gehenna in there, and it's getting worse. And I remember sitting on the steps, and with this Friedman and the others, he was the only one that was a chayav. And then they stopped the music, and he hears the number, whatever it is, Tesha, and then we see his face goes ashen. He was a commando, he had a commando unit, they called him. And he didn't say a word, and he stood like we're all looking at him. And then he looks at one of an American, and he says, "Israel, can I take your shoes?" He had a good pair of shoes. This Israeli was a poor guy. They're always poor. He had torn shoes. Didn't have good shoes. He's going now. He has to report. He didn't have shoes, so he asked this guy, "Can I have your shoes?" And I still remember they're exchanging the shoes, and we said goodbye to him, and we said goodbye, and he walked out with the shoes. And that was a very tender moment, a very serious but tender moment, but it got worse and worse. And 3 o'clock in the morning was that story, you see in the mirror when you go down, there's a whole section missing, was the direct hit on the building. That moment, the whole building was shaking, all the plaster was coming down. We all became, when plastic comes down, you get white, and you wait for the roof to fall in. And Rabaria Finkel got up,
And Uriah says, Shema, and he says, Shema, he says, everybody says together, you have the women, the children, the men, everybody together. He says, then he says, Baruch Shem, Baruch Shem, three times. And then Hashem will make him, Hashem will make him. We say, Vida, already, the building is coming down. And he's screaming, Hashem will make him. And it's an extraordinary, I mean, the extraordinary moment. I'm reliving it now, I'm even thinking of it now. I remember Sid Gerudin, I remember where I was standing. And we're waiting. And then an aluf comes down, a general comes in, and he went over to Chaim Shalev. This is the toughest moment of the whole thing. And he said, Chaim didn't know Hebrew, he couldn't speak Hebrew, he couldn't hear, he was deaf. Didn't know Hebrew, well, he was deaf also. So he starts talking, so interpreting. He wants him to move all the women and the children to this side of the big Cheder Ochel. It was in the Cheder Ochel, it was downstairs in the Mikvah. And here should be all the men on this side. And he wants they should take a sledgehammer, and make a little hole over here in the wall, a secret hole that nobody should see. So when the Arabs come in, because they're fighting now, Givat HaTachmoshet, doesn't look good, we lost a lot of soldiers. They're coming in. They're getting closer, they're coming in. They'll come in, at least some of the children you'll be able to shtup out, and some of the women you'll be able to save them. So Reb Chaim started to cry. He started to chias neirois. Chias neirois. He couldn't. Basically, he's telling them they're all gone. The whole flock is gone. And everybody turned ashen, but you didn't have enough time. He turned to the Bacharim and he said, "Take the chairs." They didn't have chairs like that then. Remember, all we had chairs, wooden, plain wood chairs, slats. Take the wood chairs, break them, and you have 5 minutes, make as sharp as you can, and make a goyro. And there were 15 young men. And you'll stand by the steps where they come in. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. When the Arabs come in, he gets killed number one. The next one gets killed number two. The next one gets killed number three. But each one who gets killed, you have a stick in your hand. Maybe for 1 second, you could stop him. You poke him, you So every split second, that will allow another child or another woman to run out. We don't believe what we're hearing. And he walks out. And the army guy just made the hole in the wall. I mean, this took them like a minute. And we broke the chairs. And everybody got we were by the midbar, so we had a knife. And we start, and we make a glare. I was number 7. And there was a number 1, there was a number 2. 7 was right when they would come down, they have to walk. If you ever went in the Miri Yeshiva, you come down the steps and you turn into the Ulam, that's where the Til Shadayim places. That was my place. And I took a stick, and I was sitting on the floor. And I just as I didn't believe what I was doing, guys. And waiting, and you hear upstairs the running back and forth, running back and forth. And still, there's still the Totachim are going. So plaster is still coming down. And I'm thinking to myself, I hope the building comes down. I don't want to think of the other way. And we keep saying, and I hear someone mumbling, and this one's mumbling, Shem Olikim. And this is mumbling, Shema Yisrael again. And there was such yush at that moment, but at the other hand, I think that was the pivotal moment. Then we all, okay, so that's it. And there was a calmness. And from that moment, a certain calmness. Oh, what happened was, over the next hour, with Ezra Sashem, they all, the Yidden had the upper hand on Givat HaTachmoshet, and they defeated on that Halakha ground, and that holy ground where there's so much Yiddish blood, they were able to chase them away. And the mortar fire almost stopped. You saw that they were fleeing. By Tuesday morning, we had heard that Sahal had
chased them toward Hebron. I think Moti Gur then said, it was Tuesday morning already, I think Moti Gur was at the Kotel, right? Tuesday morning. So we made it through that terrible night, but nobody went out because there was still a lot of fighting. Not in Givat HaTachmoshet, but there was fighting all around in different little holes and places in the old city. There was on Wednesday already, over the radio came a pkuda, they were allowed to go out of the miklat, but they advised everybody to stay in because there were a lot of tzalafim. You know what tzalafim are? Snipers. Tzalafim are snipers. A lot of, they fought to the death, the Jordanians. So they were willing to stay in their places. So I'm not, I may be reckless, but I'm not crazy. So I'm not going out. There's no way I'm going out, because they say. So I had three of my friends, they say, come on, Moshe, let's go, we could go out, we could go. I said, you crazy? You heard on the radio, this telephone, what are you going? No, we gotta see. I said, what do you want to see? I'm staying here, you're on the sugarness, I'm staying here, I'm not going out. I thought I was even angry at them. I remember, you're not allowed, I'll be did, and I'm arguing, and they're going out. And they're fighting with me. I told you I was in Israel for about 3 years. Do you know the 3 years I was there, I hadn't had a Coca-Cola. You didn't have in the United States, in Israel then. There was no, out of the United States, there was no Coca-Cola. You know, there was no Pepsi either. Pepsi had made a boycott. It was very famous. Pepsi made a boycott against Israel. They went with the Arab boycott. The only place you can get a Pepsi was in the old city. So they said, are you crazy? Come with us. We'll go out and we'll go to the old city. I said, no, we'll get killed. They said, but you get a Pepsi. Let's go. I went. And I wrote to the Pepsi company, have the best advertisement in history. I will make an advertisement if you pay me that I risk my life for a Pepsi. And I actually went to the old city and I got a Pepsi Cola. I got a Pepsi Cola Yom Revi'i Yeshuk. You know, you went by Shah. I went by Shar Shem. By Shar Shem on the way. There was stores around there. But I also remember that on Thursday I went out and the Yerushalayim showed me how you can go across the Midrash, you can go across the Givat HaTachmoshet, the Ammunition Hill. They've taken all the Jewish bodies and you know everything was taken care of. And you go to the Kever of Shimon HaTzadik. No one had been by Shimon HaTzadik since 1948, so I wanted to go to be Mispah. I couldn't go to the Kaisel yet. They wouldn't let you go to the Kaisel. But I wanted to go, so let me go be Mispah by Shimon HaTzadik. So I went. How do you say mines?
Mokshim.
They say you have to be careful not to step on a mine. Be careful. What I know the mine was. But they told me to be careful. So I was careful. I permitted to step on a mine. You know what? They hadn't taken away the bodies of the Jordanians yet. There were still like hundreds of pedurim all over the field stinking. It was in the summer. They stink. And maggots were all in their eyes. He saw really the devastation of war. Them taking the bodies away yet. And I went to Shimon HaTzadik. And seeing the dead Jordanians gave me an idea of the brutality of Milchama. And you realize the magnitude of the mess. You know what happened was this. Here was a moment that, by all rights, I should not be speaking in front of you. I should be dead. And in the Yiddish, there's an expression, it's a geschenk to yon. There's a lot of Holocaust survivors used to say, gift. These years are a gift because they should have been dead. Everybody in there is who should have been dead. By all normal accounts. David, you know, he did a made of serendipity. And serendipity was this. Not only did he allow us to live, to snatch, I guess you would say, victory from the jaws of defeat, but not only to snatch life from the jaws of death. So we lived. That in itself was an extraordinary thing. But for 2,000 years, everybody prayed the same prayer. What was that? They said, Hedena, Hedena, Beshuvatim, nobody got it. Nobody really got it. And here, for the first time, in the moment when we thought it was all over, we weren't even seeking you. In our biggest halomos, you could have written fiction of fiction. And I would tell somebody in 67, we're going to have the Kaisel, and the whole Eretz Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael Ashlema was for us. They would say that this is not fiction, this is crazy. And serendipity. And he dropped it into our laps. And he gave us everything. Unfortunately,
even though he gave us everything. You read in the parsha last week. I think it says, "Ushmarta mis mishmarti, vasisa mis chukosai, vishavta betam be'atzachem." And then it says, "Venosna ha'oretz piriyo, v'yashavtem be'atzachem betach." Why does it say twice? You sit in security in your land. It shouldn't say twice. You only one would be enough. So the answer is, the Brisker Rav asks the same question. When you say Birchas HaChodesh, when we say Birchas HaChodesh, Chaim Shel Yerushamayim V'Yerushchei, what goes next? Chaim Shem Behem Bushel Klimo, and Chaim Shel Yerushchei, Chaim Shel Yerushchei, Abbas Torah, V'Yerushchei, you already said Yerushamayim. Remember, you just said it a minute ago, right? You said, Chaim Shel Yerushchei, Yerushamayim V'Yerushchei. Why do you say Abbas Torah V'Yerushamayim? Why do you say twice Yerushamayim? So the Brisker Rav says, in the middle between the both of them, you said Chaim Shel Oysher V'Kovet. He gives you a lot of money and he gives you a lot of covet. You need another brother for your Shemar. Got to have another one. I need another one. You know what? First it says, Nebishtha gave us an Yisrael. He gave us a Matana. And he gave us a Matana because there were a lot of Eden at that time. And then there was big exclusion from the Mishmartim is Mishmartim, Vasisim is Kukoisai, Mishavtim Betan Be'artim, just like that Tochim. But then, you know what happened after the ensuing years? The Nost Ortiz is period. The land gave us its fruit. It was the most beautiful Earth Israel. Earth Israel blossomed in ways that no one could have dreamed. 100, at my time there were 20, did I mention that today or someone else, was, maybe from this in Kaplan, there was 25 yeshivas maybe in Yerushalayim in my time. 25 yeshivas. You know how many yeshivas are in Yerushalayim today? 300. You know there's 300 yeshivas that, I guess there could be probably more. I only mentioned because Misrad Adatot, money, yeshivas that take money from Misrad Adatot. That's a certain kind of yeshiva. There are a lot of yeshivas. The Hasidic yeshivas won't take money from Israel at all. So you're right. It's probably maybe even double. There are only 25 yeshivas. There weren't that many people in Israel. Israel was very tiny. From the Mashbir Merkaziz to Zechar. Mashbir Merkaziz till Sanhedrin Molchem. I used to walk one time in Israel, the whole Israel. I knew everybody in Israel. Everybody knew each other. It was a tiny Israel. Enough knowledge is period. Make yeshivas in learning and Torah and Yerushalayim opportunities for America for football. Eibishter gave us the dreams that we couldn't dream. You know what? We need a new bracha mishavta betta v'atzacha. Now that he gave us the oishah v'kovet, and look, they're trying to give it back. They're trying to give it away. Evil people. We're surrounded by evil people who have no love for Eretz Yisrael, no love for Torah, no love for the Rebbeinu Shel, no love for Am Yisrael. And they want to give it away. And they give it away in the name of security, they give it a name. Everybody, the Yetzirah, I think the Gemara Sukkah says Yetzirah, seven names, yeah? Now one of the names is security, the other name of the Yetzirah is, you know, from economy, the name of the is for peace. There's all kinds of Yetzirah, other names now. And they come, the Yetzirah, to give away Eretz. Whoever heard such a thing? 2,000 years we pray, Abraham should give us Eretz Yisrael. Finally, Abraham gives us Eretz Yisrael. In a short period of time, what do we do like crazy people? We give away Eretz. No, am I right? You need a special bracha. Vishavtem betach be'artzachem. We have to be mispowered so strong. And the way we keep Eretz Yisrael, I want to tell you, it's not old people like me. It's not going to keep Eretz Yisrael. It's the young people, the soldiers. You're the young soldiers. And you're like the Kohanim Gedolim that are sitting in the Kodesh Kedoshim when you sit with a Gemara. Even if somebody, you know what, everybody says, so what can I contribute? You know what you contribute? You go into a Seder. How long is a Seder? 3 hours? 2.5 hours? You know what? You take the Seder and you say, I don't have anything to do with Freya. The one thing that I can do for my contribution to Eretz Yisrael, at least make Torah Eretz Yisrael better than Torah Chutzlaret, at least make Torah Eretz Yisrael like this guy in his name, at least make Torah, that's your opportunity. You have a school to learn here. My time, guys, didn't go to Eretz Yisrael. I went there to Israel. They didn't have a minion in Mir Yeshiva, Yantav Sheni, and Kutzvah, nothing like that. I didn't have a minion, Yantav Sheni. And no Americans. The Americans didn't go in those days. Now, which American doesn't go? There's a tremendous risk that your generation has. You don't fumble the ball. You don't want to fumble the ball. You have tremendous responsibility.
the tremendous responsibility. I obviously, everybody feels grateful. You feel grateful to your Rosh Hashivas, you feel grateful to your parents, you feel grateful to Rabbein who gave you the opportunity. But once you pick up and you take the responsibility, don't flub it, don't drop it. Tremendous responsibility. The stronger young people like yourselves will learn, the longer you will learn as well. I tell you the truth, I know many, maybe it's not my place to say it, but I say it whenever I see young people. I know many made agreements with their parents to go for 1 year and they can't stay for a second year. You don't fight with parents. I don't ever believe to fight with parents. But if you have susim, I want to tell you something, you try everything you can to tell your parents, for all of us, for their benefit, for your benefit, give me another year. Give me another half a year. Come back for a shana, but come back for another year. Because everybody knows, is there comparison the first year, the second year? Second year is always tremendous, much more intense learning. You grow in 1 month in the second year like you grew in 4 or 5 months the first year. It's a tremendous chus. So I know for many of you it's very hard. It's easier said than done. But for those of you who still are like on the fence, you're on the bubble, you're not sure, and even though some of you are sure, maybe you reconsider. Try and stick here, because there's no Torah like Torah's hands to throw. The moments, even the minutes that you will put in here will be Seidel Adarach for you the rest of your life. It won't just be like a chizik. There's a difference. You know what Seidel Adarach is? What's Seidel Adarach? Do you know what Seidel Adarach is? Seidel Adarach is like this. When it says in the Torah, before you go on a trip, you're not supposed to go to empty pouch. You have to put food in there. Because on the way, you're going to have to eat. I say it's a short trip, you never know. Always take Seidel Adarach. Seidel Adarach, year you put over here, and then you throw 2 years you put here, that's not just like a little learning that you did. That's Seidel Adarach for the rest of your life. You're going to pull that out in 10 years from now. You're going to pull out a Monday that you learned a line in Gemara, somehow you're going to put, and that's going to sustain you that day. And in 20 years from now, when you're married, you have your own children, you don't realize you're going to pull out with not just the word you learned, but the ruchnius that you got here. That's in a pouch, and you're going to pull it out, and that's what's going to sustain you in 20 years from now. The learning you do in the United States, you come back, whatever, that's every day you have a scar. It's not going to sustain you. This is what sustains you. It will sustain you for the rest of your life. For the rest of your life, this is going to sustain you. You see, I tell all the stories now to you, 41 years, 22 years ago, like it happened yesterday. You know, this sustained me my whole life. This experience sustained me my whole life. May change my life, everything. Your Shemayim, my Avos HaTorah, my Adukis and my Rosh Hashivas. Rosh Hashivas became then like my parents. That's when I really felt the strength of Kesher, of Bond. And I hope for all of you, you know, this should be a tremendous experience for you, which I know it is, but build on it. Build on it and you be the block that makes it Vishavta Beth of Yad. Thank you very much. Can I ask you one thing though before you go? I really didn't... I'm not a good recruiter anyway, but I have some of these brochures that will give you an idea of what the yeshiva is.